Welcome back to the Preacher Podcast. We are continuing with our series for the season of Lent called Exactly What I Need. I'm John Mitchell from Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary. With me for this series, Pastor Aaron Getzinger from Good Shepherd in Attleboro, Massachusetts, and Pastor Caleb Kerbis, who is starting a new mission in Erie, Colorado. Caleb, Aaron, good to be with you. Let's just review for the preachers who are working with this series, what this Sunday within the Exactly What I Need series is all about. Aaron, could you just remind preachers of this Sunday's theme and how it fits into the series theme?
We're in the first Sunday of Lent, or in Lent, and we will be looking at exactly what I need, a champion. And so there's two thoughts. On the one hand, we are stuck. Humanity is stuck. And maybe this is an offensive truth because, as we'll see in our preaching, that maybe it's not my fault. I wasn't the one who committed the first sin and plunged all of humanity into the situation where we are traveling towards death. And so death is coming, and it can't be stopped. And so we need someone or something to enter into the equation, and that is Christ. There is no reason for grace other than God's abundance of love for his creation. So he sends someone to battle in our place against sin and death and the devil.
Thank you. And before we get into the second reading, the reading from Romans as our sermon text today, Caleb, could you remind preachers what the other readings of the day are?
Yeah, the Old Testament reading is Genesis chapter 3, the first promise. In order for there to be a champion, we zero in on where the original humans fell apart, Adam and especially being highlighted in this Sunday. And since he n never could be or never would be the champion, not only for himself or others, but proved to be quite the opposite in his sin and the humanity along with him, God then promised a champion. And that text is just riddled with conflict, the conflict that God would bring as he would now intercede in sending his son to crush the serpent's head. The gospel, the temptation in the wilderness of Jesus, he goes toe to toe out in the wilderness against the Satan and the temptations that came along with his separation during that time. And yet what we see Jesus doing is not only demonstrating, as he uses the word, how to overcome the devil, but being for us what none of us could be or become on our own. And then, of course, Romans 5, which serves as this commentary. You could even say it's the intersection. It's a commentary on the Old Testament reading in a way, but also it points the large index finger at the gospel reading too. Such a tight fit, all of them.
Right. Romans brings the other two accounts together, the two men that we'll be talking about. Let's go there then. Romans 5, verses 12 through 19. Aaron, let's start with you. Just some highlights in the text for things that preachers might find noteworthy as they prepare a sermon. Challenging because there's a lot to talk about here. But yeah, I'll turn things over to you. What are some especially noteworthy points for preachers?
Yeah, there is a lot to talk about. And so it does start with a therefore, which automatically puts us to what precedes. I'm not going to discuss that too much other than to say, go and read verses 1 through 11 of this section. Very helpful because here is where Paul is driving his conversation and his point. He's getting to this idea of original guilt. And he proves it by saying death came to all men and then point to all sinned. And so you already in this first verse, you have the great villains of this section introduced to us, where sin and death are almost personified. He'll say later on in verse 14 that death rules as a king, right? It is a power that is has come into the world. The verb he uses in that section is interesting too. It's almost like it has, right, penetrated us in some way. It has traveled through us. And so there's no avoiding the consequence of sin that is death. And it's easy to look at this section and go, well, I reject this, right? I am not that bad. I haven't done anything wrong. Why is it that I have to bear the consequences of Adam's and Eve's problems, right? And yet, Paul doesn't really allow much wiggle room in this. It's the reality of the way the world works. If I am, I was kind of thinking, if I'm hiking on a trail and whether there's a sign telling me it's a dangerous trail or not, there is still a danger of me falling off and dying. And similarly, death is the consequence of sin, whether there is a law pointing out my failure or not, right? And Paul kind of speaks to this when he's talking about Adam and how this death prevails even before there was a law to point out the problem of sin, as you know, sin as a or l the law as a diagnostic tool to help us see all of our failures. So he sets up the like 12 through 14, it's such a miserable situation we find ourselves in, right? Death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, the lawgiver. And those who did not sin by breaking a command as Adam did, who is the pattern of the one to come. So now he's setting up this typological relationship between Adam and Christ. But in verse 15, he's going to qualify that relationship by using that word. But the gift is not like the trespass. And so really the typical logical relationship is really a study in contrasts now. So where, I think it's, you could do it Adam versus Christ. You could do it the trespass versus the gift, right? The gift is by grace. The gift results in life, whereas the trespass results in death. The gift is won for us. The gift is abundant. And while certainly 12 through 14 doesn't really use the idea of scarcity, right? There is an idea of wasting away under this rule of death. The gift is from God, whereas the trespass is from the one man. The gift is given with all generations in mind, right? That idea of the many being repeated. This is for the many. This is for all of humanity. And the gift is selflessness, whereas the trespass itself is selfishness in the full. I'll keep going on. I know there's tons more to talk about in these sections, but I just don't want to keep hogging all the airwaves. So,
Well, let's, do you want to note a couple more things, Aaron?
I'll pause there, Caleb, if
Okay,
you want to
sure.
hop in, if you have anything, or John.
Yeah, Caleb,
Sure.
you want
I was
to
enjoying it, Aaron.
note?
The comparison thing, one of the thing I thought of is like, and everybody might have different opinions on visuals, but because there are such strong and clear patterns, it might be helpful in some way, maybe for a listener to think about either in preaching as they're listening, how to, like you were just doing, how you're setting these on the scale next to one another, so you get the nuance of what Paul is saying, because there are so many of them, and they are so, like you said, a picture in contrast. So whether a person does that in their words, or even if somebody wanted to do that in print, or however, I wonder if how creative a preacher could be as they start to think about, because it's so loaded with these contrasts, which really do bring out Paul's argument as he's logically laying out all these dominoes that explain this main point that he said. A couple therefores, as you said, precede this, but just he makes this big point in verse 12, and then is adding these explanatory comparisons in order to build that out first or further. You use the word this typological comparison. That's exactly what he says. I keyed into that. I think we all would just by glancing at the Greek. It's not hard Greek, but just to see what this ultimate pattern is like. And really, I think it'd be easy to talk about it in a way that's so objective. And I know we'll get to this in a little bit. But to think of what really makes Adam a type in contrast, and how he's describing us too. This is humanity. This is mankind in its the core of its of our plight. And so I wonder too how creative the preacher can be in expounding upon this to already maybe talk in such a way that you can start to lay the groundwork for people to see themselves in this. The way he's talking about Adam is he's talking about us too. So those two things were kind of the big highlights for me.
I think that's that in some ways that has to be the hook, right? Because just I'm thinking of this from, preaching to a more, in my context, a more secular culture or audience. And the concept of objective guilt is a foreign concept. And I think that's across the board. I mean, it's not just because I have a sinful nature, and it is because of that, but it's also we just don't think about it in that way as 21st century Americans. Like, my guilt is something I carry with me where I feel it because I have realized I've done something wrong. But Paul isn't really speaking about it that way. And to your point, I think the way in which you get there is by helping our listeners see themselves in Adam, and that's the way where we can, myself too, because I'm guilty of that as well. I don't want to think that, yeah, it's Adam's fault, not mine.
Yeah,
But I
like,
am Adam.
yeah, and of any of these texts in these epistles, because they're so rich in doctrine, I wonder, I don't know if this is actually true or an overstatement, but I wonder if it's easy to become more just expository or explanatory in nature, or if there might be a pitfall for the preacher to miss some of the applications. I don't. I've heard that before. I need maybe look back and take a survey of my own sermons and see if I've fallen into that trap. I probably have. But to your point, yeah, the way how we totally avoid that for our listeners is to get them, especially like you said, the hook right away, that a major law hook. Not to get ahead of ourselves too much, but that they themselves by their own volition start to identify with Adam, and it is really inescapable. I mean, just the things that he says, I love that part too. Why does he bring up this idea of death reigning? You know, like you said, it penetrates us, it rules. I also was thinking like how that's generational too. Like, how do you make this stark? Like, why is it you don't have great grandparents anymore? Or maybe you do. But if not them, the ones before them, like what, how inescapable this is. And Paul's really just putting with all these comparisons, these pieces together. So as I was thinking about this and all these comparisons, and I was just thinking maybe one of the hardest first tasks would be to lay this out in such a way so that how can I get my listener to say, yeah, this, I really do see this, and I can't escape it either. 'Cause you're right. I find that too in talking to people, like what is guilt really? It's not this, it's a lot different than thus saith the Lord, and therefore you accept it. It's I don't feel that. I don't feel that, therefore, or that's your truth, that's not, whatever it is. So yeah.
Yeah, I kind of think the Paul's words about death, claiming, reigning, claiming everybody, that's maybe a way to get into it because nobody can deny that, right? I mean, death claims people. We're subject to it, and then kind of get from there to, well, why would this be? Here's what the Bible says. It's that we're all together subject to death because we're all together as a human race at odds with God, and kind of approach the issue of guilt that way. Death being evidence that something's wrong here between creator and his creation, between God and humanity. Well, let's talk then. You mentioned law and gospel in the text. Adam and Jesus would be law and gospel, right? But how do you bring that out, and bring it home to listeners, law and gospel, as you look at the contrast that's here? Any suggestions for preachers beyond what we've said so far, Aaron?
Yeah, maybe. So I'm looking mainly at verse 19 right now, where Paul writes, "For just as through the disobedience of the one man the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man the many will be made righteous." And the fact that it's the obedience was interesting to me, right? And very often when we hear about Christ's obedience, and rightly so, it's his act of obedience, him keeping the law perfectly in my place. But if you know, if you think of it in terms of what is the most profound single act of obedience that Christ carried out, it would be the fact that he actually carried out his Father's will to die on the cross, right? So you have him in the Garden of Gethsemane saying, "Not my will, but your will be done." And I kind of thought of my own new man, my new self, who loves to say that, and rightly so. But the problem is, I have this old Adam who comes around, who does not want me to say that, and then it takes advantage of all of the external opportunities for me to carry out my own personal will, you know. And that is sins which will lead me to death, you know. And then Christ goes, and you think about all of the external things acting upon him to cause him to deviate away from carrying out his Father's will. You have the crowd jeering him, you know, mocking him. You have a prisoner, him, you know, a guy under the same sentence making fun of him. You know, if you are the Son of God, save yourself and us. You know, my sinful flesh would go, "All right, I'll show you guys who this is." And yet Christ, he stays on the cross. Remarkable. The obedience through which we are made righteous. And I think that it could be a really cool opportunity to talk about Christ's obedience in a way that we maybe don't always have opportunity to talk about, specifically his obedience to his Father's will, his act of obedience. It was an act of doing on the cross as much as it was being done to him.
You have the first re excuse me, the gospel reading of the day too, pointing out right the face off against the devil, and there's Christ, his act of obedience highlighted, of course. But I think you're right, Aaron, that it's both together, both that and his submitting to his Father's will. Caleb, other thoughts, maybe perhaps on law or malady?
Yeah, and he sparked a thought, you know, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, as you're bringing up those Holy Week events. So yeah, this active and passive altogether in this dikaioi, this righteousness, this obedience, or the thing that makes him righteous, of course. But they know not what they do. It kind of I was reminded of that as I was looking at the point that Paul's making in verse 14 when he says, "Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command." We know the ones to whom he's talking, and the case that he's trying to make, of course. There, it seems to me that there's also this case that he's making for people who think, well, what if the command is not there, or they're not even aware of it? And I think that's very pertinent to what we were discussing before about people who would not assign the blame to themselves to the degree to which it's true. But Jesus knows, and he knows the degree to which, and he's willing to go to those to that degree, even if they know not what they do. The way that Paul is, I think, a malady approach would be, there's a version of this psalm in the Psalter and in the New Hymnal Resources, of Psalm 139, and it's a rendition of Psalm 139. He says, "I know not all my own heart and mind." I don't even know the degree to which, and yet even in that, he's making it so painstakingly clear that it leads to death, which isn't escapable. So maybe could we at least acknowledge that for even the stuff that's unknowable, the thoughts of attitude and heart, all of which have been sinful and lead to death. Even that, I'm making a lesser to greater argument here, because I think, for the inclination that people would have to not assign blame, he's making it painstakingly clear that there is no excuse. And therefore, even if we can get a person to recognize, like, oh yeah, even that, or I never even thought about that, then the door's wide open. Then the door's wide open, then there's no excuse. The door being analogous to God's punishment then in his indictment against us. So, and if that is the case, then the fact that Jesus, he does know the full extent and would still go and be the ultimate obedient one, And these, of course, huge words that we would want to explain come out: justification, righteousness, obedience, what that actually means, not better than my neighbor, not good-er compared to the garbage man in life, but obviously to God's holy standards. So I would say fine-tooth combing a little bit in those verses, but maybe that might be helpful or an option.
Yeah, thank you. So we've touched on kind of gospel thoughts a little bit when Aaron, you mentioned the obedience of Christ, but anything further on that, aspects of the gospel in addition to that, or continuing along those same lines that you would emphasize throughout the sermon?
I don't know if this would necessarily be an emphasis, but maybe a way to do the gospel if a preacher is going to do that study and contrasts approach. The entire approach between Adam and Christ are contrasts with each other. Adam wanted to be like God, and so he sins, and the result is he plunges all of the world into death. And what does Christ himself do? He gives up all access to his mighty power, takes on human flesh, pursues death itself so that many might live. And I think that could be a real, also a powerful way to bring even more emphasis on that other side of the scale. I read somewhere like, there's all these comparisons being made, but there's really no comparison because it's not an even comparison. There's so much weight on the gift side of the scale that it's automatically like, what are we even comparing here? Like it's life and death. I'm going to choose life. There's no option,
Exactly, yeah. Further gospel thoughts, Caleb?
Yeah, there's to key off the idea of the type or the pattern, there is this unavoidable script that's been written throughout humanity, and it's baked in, it's woven into the pattern of all of us, not only according to our sinful DNA, but even just as we pass it along, and it's the wide array and how much it covers. It's just the script has been written. And I maybe that analogy works, or certainly like most, it limps in some parts, but you have this sizable rewriting of the script, and it would take something like God. So another way of putting that maybe would be when sin entered, death filled the vacuum left behind, and the only thing that could undo that would have to be bigger than both of those things. So just that keying more off of how something is always going to have to fill that vacuum. And it's always going to have to be bigger and stronger than the thing that filled it before. And it just so happens that that's exactly what God was in the business of doing. And praise be to him for that. Another thing that just is always a healthy challenge for us to view some of the young people sitting in the pews and the chairs before us as we talk about things like righteousness and justification. I find myself when I'm thinking about catechism kids or my own kids or others' kids, or if a person does a children's message in a sermon, if that's your practice, how to explain these concepts in a way where you could actually leverage that to not only better reach those children, but of course, if you're better reaching the children, I don't think I'm the only preacher who has had someone tell me like, "Yeah, your sermon it was good, but man, your children's message was way better." It's always humbling for a preacher to hear that. It's like thank you. But just these ideas of righteousness, so moral symmetry to God, and what that looks like a butterfly with two beautiful wings. It needs both of them to be beautiful. If it had a little stubby one, it wouldn't be. Whatever analogy, there's a great opportunity because at the heart of these words is the work of Christ and what he did for us. Another thing that's not said, but just to be able to say it as clearly as possible. It might also be a pitfall to talk about the gospel in the text that's so saturated with the gospel, but to proclaim the gospel actually to the people as though this is a status that has been conferred upon them in their baptism and through the proclamation of the word. What a great opportunity. Lord, don't let us miss that opportunity to say, and this is now who you are. This is how now what God has made you to be as you're wrapped up into this one who is justification and righteousness for you. So that
Yeah,
guns of
I think that's really helpful, Caleb. And when it is it verse 14? Let me just scroll back here real quick. I think it's verse 14 where it says, well, anyway, it's the part where oh no, I think it's 17. We reign with Christ now, those who receive the gift. Yeah, the righteous reign in life in verse 17. I think like thinking about what Jesus said, I have come that they may have life and life to the full, right? In some ways, these are two different ways of life now that are being pitted against each other too. It's not life in an abstract sense that I'm looking forward to it, but this has come now back into my life in the present day, right? I have been completely freed by ha from having to earn some kind of favor from God so that I'm finally enough for him. He's given me life, and a life where I don't have to worry every day when I wake up about what God thinks about me, because his grace is abundance, and abundant yet today. So yeah, I think that is a really helpful point, Caleb, in terms of preaching the gospel. Preach it to the people. Like, we can get caught up in the doctrinal thoughts in each of these verses.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the role of a preacher here. This is very universal in the language Paul uses, and kind of it's just the broad sweep of history going back to the very beginning through the life of Jesus. The preacher's job then is to bring that home to people and say, you're in this, right? All of us are in this these words. Not explicitly, but when Paul speaks about Adam, that means us. When Paul speaks about Jesus and the righteous reign in life, that's us too. So we can make that connection for our listeners. You mentioned earlier kind of the challenge of using some of these big theological terms in a sermon. And I think that's good for preachers to think about. Like I had a sermon not too long ago where righteousness was a key word. And right, how do you figure that out? I think both of you have given good illustrations of that. Aaron, you said, when God can look at you and you're enough for him. I've used that similar language to describe what righteousness is, kind of in a general way. It's when you want someone to look at you and say, you're okay, you're just right. And the person we're interested in here is God himself looking at us and saying, you're just right. Well, how can that happen when we're children of Adam and we're part of this whole group of people, this mass of the human race that just is not right, is anything but right? And the key is this other man who comes in, who's actually God himself, who takes our sin and takes the blame, and now in him, we're right with God and we're enough. And so, yeah, kind of preachers might think in those types of terms. For those not familiar with the theological vocabulary, which is to say, probably most of the people listening to you, to think in those terms are depicting some of these concepts in a way that people can grab onto them or identify with them a little bit. Speaking of kind of bringing things home to people, any suggestions for doing just that, either illustrating or applying or thoughts for appropriation, bringing some of these truths right into the lives of listeners. Any suggestions for preachers how you might go about that? In addition to the ones you've already mentioned. Further thoughts on that, Aaron?
Sure. I have been thinking about it through the lens of Christ Jesus lay in death's strong bands, where it says, when life and death contended, right? And you kind of see that mashup here, where you have life under death, and then life for us under this concept of the gift of life. So I was kind of thinking about painting it in pictures of King Death and then King Jesus. And even though it is pretty filled with great points of doctrine, There's also a drama unfolding in this section when you read it. I think it's a for how dogmatic it is, it's extraordinarily dramatic in the way it describes the reality of death in our own lives and the reality of life that comes to us in Christ. So on the one hand, I think you could kind of paint this I don't want to push it too far because I there are certainly blessings in this world that God gives us. But keying off of what Paul says, you know, kind of paint this a world. Have your listeners imagine a world where, you know, something to the effect of like, you know, everything's in black and white. People are slumping under their shoulders under the burden of their work. They eat food, but they're never full. They try to find entertainment, but they're never satisfied, right? Just this kind of a world that is marked by decay and evil and scarcity. It's the kind of world you would never want to live in. And then you can turn it and say, but at the very same time, that's our reality without Christ. That's the world you're stuck in without him. And there is no way you can claw yourself out of that kind of world. You need a rescue from it, which you can then move to King Jesus, who brings in a new kind of life and rule that is marked by eternal life and righteousness and abundance. And where there is transgression, now there is forgiveness. And where there is death, there is life to the full. Right. And then finally, I think you can move to it, take all of that, Christ's obedience, and now apply it to us, really keying off of verse 17, where we are kings along with him. And we reign in this life that he has given to us. And you can I think that's really where the application section will come in, and maybe listening to Caleb's right encouragement, that's where you can maybe avoid that pitfall of just talking about the gospel rather than preaching the word and planting it home.
Yeah. Caleb, thoughts on kind of bringing this into the people's lives? You've shared some good thoughts already. Something further?
The idea of how, so he, I like what he said about the drama. Like you have this just power struggle that is unfolding, and some of which, whether it's recognized or not, as we've kind of commented on enough or probably already, the power struggle is still there. And the more we realize it, the more we recognize our ineptitude to escape it. We can't claw our way out, as Aaron just said. So the script is written, and I'll maybe use that as a little bit of a double entendre. Like there is this drama, like the script has been written, but also there's another kind of script. It's the like the prescription that we're whatever we're trying to give ourselves, and however we might try to escape, we can't. We need this entire thing d done, redone, I mean, and that's where Christ comes in. So an analogy for that would be, you know, there's a lot of experts that would say that for children that are born into certain families where there's maybe some types of abuse or substance or addiction or whatever, they would say the script is written. And to a certain degree, like just the numbers are staggering when you kind of dig into those. But and aside from any debate on those things, but just if you start looking at those things, it's a real sad story. It's a real sad story. I think that's very much analogous to what is so different about me and whatever I've inherited from my parents and they from theirs and they from theirs. And what have we at our core really inherited? It's not just, you know, a combination of personality traits with a dash of DNA that made us uniquely our own, but it is this part of our fiber type of inescapable DNA that spiritually, eternally, we cannot escape or erase or rewrite on our own. And so just to think about how the demise is already written, there's no like, oh, maybe somebody, a kid who's kind of born into this terrible foster abuse kind of situation, like the odds are really against them, but maybe they could. And who's the ones who say that when it comes to ourselves and our own eternal plight? Like we tell ourselves that, but that's not true. And Paul's covering, of course, all of that with these logical comparative dominoes to mix metaphors. But I like that analogy because it presents an opportunity to highlight the ways that where Christ intercedes. So he's rewriting the script. He's not bettering humanity. He is redoing what the ultimate champion had to do in order to redeem us. So that's maybe a way of approaching it. I had maybe one other one, which is just there's a lot going on today about like becoming the ultimate or the better version of yourself, especially health and wellness is on the rise more today than maybe in recent years. And with all of that, there's this nuance that baked into us. I know Paul's not getting to this point here. We can save that for chapter seven. The desire to try to want to do more, even though you can't. However, what is the natural comeback to the points that Paul is making? I think there's something there to that the preacher could probably explore, so that when we recognize that, of course, sin is here to stay, death reigns, condemnations is that's it. Then Jesus is the only ultimate one who could come in to fill the vacuum, or to redo the vacuum that death had filled after sin had been reigning since the time of Adam. So, couple thoughts there.
Very helpful. Lot to get preachers thinking. As far as kind of a central thought for a sermon or a theme idea or kind of how to put the sections of the sermon together, any ideas to share there that might get preachers thinking, even if it's in kind of a rough form at this stage? Aaron?
So I'm usually, I'm not typically a theme and parts preacher. I usually just hammer one point over and over, and maybe that's for better or worse. So I really think if, with that in mind, it would have to be something to the effect of Christ is the king who brings life, or Christ is the obedient one, something along those lines, where right, we said before that there's really no comparison in this ongoing contrast that's going on here. And so I think a very clear statement of there's so much to get bogged down on in this text where it could become a real drudgery is, I guess, is where I'm trying to avoid. There's a lot of law that I don't think, at least for myself, as I think about this, I don't know if we need to focus. Death is the great equalizer in the end anyway, right? And I don't know how much I need to hammer how much the world stinks for people. But what they probably need to hear over and over again is Christ is the better Adam and all of the gifts of life that come along with that. Maybe that's a little just generic. I don't know. But I think this is a great opportunity to talk about some of the simple gospel truths in a way that are very clear and speak directly to people. You know, it's simple, but it's not simplistic.
Yeah, there's Adam, there's Christ, and we're affected by each, but Christ is the one who reigns now, and we reign with him. Caleb, any theme ideas or putting the sermon together type of ideas?
Yeah, I like all that Aaron just said too, and maybe a way of with something that is so rich, and you're right, it would be easy to get bogged down in a number of ways with this text, how to avoid that. One of the tools I try to use, albeit not always well, is to try and find a picture, something where you can kind of come back to and that can kind of carry but keep things simple. Right. So I kind of I thought of this idea of a script, but speaking to trying to emphasize the finality of it, and therefore maybe referring to it as though as we're rewriting our own script, or the script may have already been written for us. Actually, no. That's where Jesus comes in, because he is the one where the script is rewritten, and that's done. So just trying to speak about that, to maybe use a picture like that in a way, but to emphasize the finality, because that's really the gifts that he's given. It's life, and that's not going into a tomb, and it's done. And even like the way that Paul's speaking, consequently, like it's done. It's a done deal. So just trying to find a picture where those gifts can be highlighted, whether it's the ultimate human, or a script that is rewritten. However, that's kind of where I was leaning. If sometimes play the game, if I had to preach this in 5 minutes, what would I do to keep it as simple as possible? And that's maybe where I would go.
Oh, both great ideas. I had the idea of I kind of what you were thinking, Caleb. What similar to what you mentioned too, Aaron, where you're just keeping it kind of simple. One central picture And that for me, it was like a boxing match, man versus devil. And you could picture round one as Adam versus the devil. And the devil gets the knockout. And you say, well, we're involved with this too. And then round two is Jesus, and he knocks out the devil. It kind of a simple image, but you could build your it's sort of an easy to remember maybe hook that you can build some of those deeper points off of or hang them off of. And then kind of at the end, I just thinking of contrasting round one, this happened, round two, this happened, and show the difference, kind of the way Paul lines it up in those latter verses of the text. And along the way, round one, guilty. The whole world is guilty. Paul uses the word condemnation. Round two, not guilty. Paul uses the word justification, or a way to bring in those bigger concepts. And then if you want to even say, okay, what's going to happen in round three, you can talk about, well, the devil's still hanging around. What's going to happen? We'll have battles, but in Christ, will reign. So something like that. It might be an idea that preachers could kind of work with. Well, any concluding thoughts or anything we haven't mentioned yet, or something you wanted to add?
Yeah, kind of maybe when you were talking, John, this I was thinking in terms of I had thought a little bit earlier about maybe preaching this as a narrative rather than as a straight out deductive sermon, which kind of made me, and then I thought, well, maybe that's just too weird and could get bogged down. But you describing it in terms of a boxing match, there's kind of a narrative backbone to that concept. And I was thinking in terms, in a narrative, it's always fun at the end to get kind of a reversal in some way where, whoa, that did not land in the way I was thinking it would land. And I think the place where you could do that is by saying, in the end, we rule in the place of death because of Christ. Death starts the story. In this story, death starts by ruling. But in the end, we get to rule, right? We have been placed alongside of Christ in heaven. As kings along with him. And that's such just maybe that's a way to take a section of that preachers can be very familiar with and offer a little bit of a twist on it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Death, who reigns in the end? And yeah, the reversal is well, that's you and I who are and reigning in life through Christ rather than death reigning. Good. Anything further? All right. Well, preachers, we'll turn this over to you. Have fun wrestling with this text and proclaiming these universal everybody's involved truths through Adam and through our Savior Jesus. In him, we have exactly the champion that we need.